From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, we visit the Circle City Industrial Complex, take a field trip to the western suburbs for concerts, and see World War I through Hoosier memorabilia. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll discover the 19th annual Meet the Artist exhibition at Central Library and hear about a concert with a guest appearance by a live wolf. But first, Nick Saligo has been a professional DJ in Central Indiana for more than a decade, working some of the biggest parties and clubs around. But this talented artist also has an education background, so he started his own DJ school called Decademics. Contributor Pete Brown met Nick, a.k.a. DJ Metronome, at Decademics to learn more about his story and what Indy's DJ scene is all about.
I've been DJing now for 13 years. Well, I was a music fan, obviously, and I grew up as a hip-hop fan in the late 80s and early 90s. So my brother actually kind of unintentionally helped inspire some of the interests. You know, I'm listening to De La Soul records and, you know, Special Ed records and stuff like that, LL Cool J, and you hear scratching on some of those records, and it's interesting, but as a kid, you don't really know what you're really listening to. So fast forward to late middle school, early high school, I had a friend that moved from San Jose, California, where the hip-hop and DJ scene is really, really thriving, at least it was specifically in the 90s. Mm. And there was a lot of big DJ crews out there. Some people know Mixmaster Mike, you know, from his association with the Beastie Boys, and DJ Qbert and the Beat Junkies, and just different groups out on the West Coast. Well, he was the first kid that I knew that actually owned turntables and a mixer. So I would just kind of watch him play around with it after school or whatever, and just kind of observe. And I always had some interest, but at the time I was playing soccer and traveling a lot with that, and just really didn't have a whole lot of time dedicated to it. So once I got into college and think my schedule kind of freed up a little bit, I was like, I'm going to teach myself how to DJ. Wow. So I just, bought a setup and bought some records and just kind of went at it. And I was pretty terrible for a few years, but eventually things kind of started to stick, and I certainly didn't anticipate it becoming a career, but it's worked out.
Tell us a little bit about Decademics and how you got the idea to create a school for DJing, right?
Yeah. So while I was in college, I was actually an education major and received my degree from Indiana University. And it was at that point that I had just graduated. And I remember having a conversation with my father, and he told me to go get a real job, more or less, you know, that kind of a standard conversation that college graduates have with their parents. And I told him that I thought that I wanted to see if I could make DJing work. I was also at the time doing some journalism for a hip hop website. Hmm. And that was bringing in some income. So I figured, you know, let's see how far music can take it.
Yeah.
So I essentially helped create a local chapter of the Hip Hop Congress, which I had participated in. It's a national nonprofit.
Okay.
That exists in chapters all across the country. Hmm. But I started one here in Indianapolis, and from there we got linked in with the Martin Luther King Community Center over off of 40th and Illinois, and we started just doing, you know, little programs and shows and working with kids and after school programs and things there. Hmm. We received grant funding from a local community initiative, and we got $5,000 to put towards what we called at the time Elements. It was an Elements workshop. So every week we would teach DJing, emceeing, poetry, and breakdancing.
Oh, cool.
Now, breakdancing and emceeing and poetry don't really require much money. So therefore, we were able to take the funds and buy some DJ equipment. And we started teaching classes out of there. So that's kind of what sparked sparked my interest in teaching DJing. This is in 2007. And I just figured after a couple running through the program for a couple years, I figured that we were on to something, but we needed our own space to operate out of.
Yeah, and now we're sitting in it.
Now we're sitting in it.
It's fantastic in here. The equipment and the whole environment in here is super exciting. I've got to come back when it's full of students and classes in session. But tell me a little bit about the equipment that's in here.
Yeah, so we teach on, and all of the rooms are standard Technique 1200 turntables, which are kind of like the most iconic turntable associated with DJing. Since then, the technology has evolved a little bit, but the benefit to using this particular gear, and we have a variety of different Rain DJ mixers, but the Technique 1200 allows us to teach in a way that fuses the older theories and approaches to DJing and combine it with the new technology, such as using this program called Serato, which allows us to play music off of our laptops or off of computers, but we're still DJing fundamentally the same way. So we stick to using the 1200s as a tool to bridge that gap between old and new, and all of the information pretty much translates. So what you learn on the turntable will still apply if you use different DJ equipment. There are what's known as CDJs. Some people use controllers, but the techniques that we teach essentially can translate over to whatever gear that, you know, an up-and-coming DJ or a current DJ might be using.
Looking outside of Decademics and your career as a DJ, how's Indy's DJ scene changed over your time here, and where are you seeing it going?
Well, it's I would say it's grown quite a bit, to be honest. The cool thing about indie to me is that the kind of legendary DJs that have kind of made up the scene are still involved in the scene, right? There's not necessarily a changing of the guard, but there's just, I feel like there's a lot of life because there's so many people participating in it, but in a really positive way. The DJ community here is really pretty supportive of each other. And there's just a lot happening.
You know, you're talking about the founding fathers of DJing and indie. You know, who are some of the people that, if you want to get a night out, who should we go see?
There's a number of people that I would suggest that they really kind of investigate and kind of do their research on. For me personally, DJ Top Speed has been a huge influence. He's been in the scene for a very long time. Definitely most well known as far as the technical craft. You know, he's known all across the country for his ability. He's been a huge influence on not just myself, but he's taught hundreds of DJs, you know, over the last couple decades. Indiana Jones, DJ King, DJ Tech, Slater Hogan, and John Larner have been big in the dance scene. So, I mean, there are lots of people that I would suggest that they kind of go check out and meet and talk to. You know, they're all very nice people, but they're phenomenal DJs, and they're doing, you know, they're still out here making waves, and it's really cool to see.
Any advice for anybody looking to get into this? Somebody who's been in the game for a while.
I think that the number one thing that I can say, if you're really interested, and certainly, you know, check out Decademics.com. And follow us on social media. We do have a bunch of events around the city that they can come check out, either our instructors or our students playing. But definitely listen to DJs live and kind of get an understanding of like what they're doing and how they're doing it. And more importantly, our motto with the school is you can't download practice. So everybody wants everything to be quick and easy, but understand that if this is something that you really want to learn to do, and you want to really attain these skills, it's going to take some time and some legitimate effort. It's not just a matter of buying a piece of equipment and suddenly becoming a rock star. You know, we want to make sure that we're passing on the knowledge properly and allowing the students to learn everything that there is to learn. Everything is all right, uptight, clean eyes.
Pete Brown with Nick Saligo. Indy's only DJ school opened in 2014, and you can learn more about it at decademics.com. That's DECKADEMICS.com. You can find out where to hear Nick perform by searching for DJ Metronome on Facebook, and Metronome is MetroGnome. Over the last few years, the communities just west of Indianapolis have experienced exponential growth. Arts organizations in towns including Avon, Danville, and Plainfield have bubbled up to serve their growing populations, including the Hendrix Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. I invited their founder and music director, Benjamin Del Vecchio, to talk about their concerts coming up between now and May. So you have a talent showcase coming up mid-February, right before Valentine's Day.
Yes, on the 12th, and it's a free concert. It's called Our Students Give a Recital. And many members of the Hendrix Symphony are teachers,
sure.
Either in schools or privately. And we thought, actually, I was asked, can we do something where we let our students perform? I'm sure there'll be some students will be playing concerti and rather complicated works, and there may be some students have only been studying for a year or two. It's going to be a wide variety. I haven't seen all of the program to put it together, but I'm kind of excited. It's a first for us.
And I was going to say, this is new. Mm-hmm. Your talent showcases have featured the musicians of the orchestra
right.
in the past, but not their
yeah.
students. Well, break a leg, break a string on that.
Well, we hope
time
so.
Will tell. and then a fabulous, great core piece of the repertory, Peter and the Wolf. Tell us why did you program that?
Well, I try to program music that what I say the average person on the street will like. And one of the ideas we came up with this year was Peter and the Wolf and other cartoon classics.
Oh.
Every piece on the program is from a cartoon, whether it's Walt Disney or Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes, Bugs Bunny. There's even, what is it, the Muppets, I think it's the Muppets cartoon Ode to Joy. And we're going to do a multimedia presentation.
Really?
And so you can't run the films because that's cost prohibitive.
Sure.
If you could get the permission, but you can show slides, you know, a picture of Bugs Bunny with his scissors in his hand doing the Barber
sure.
of Seville or whatever, the Rabbit of Seville, I think is the cartoon.
Oh, how fun.
You know. And we're going to have a real wolf. Well, there is a gentleman in Zionsville who owns a wolf named Blue. Blue is a very nice wolf, big guy, you know.
And well behaved.
Oh, definitely well behaved.
Okay.
But as long as I have dog treats in my tail pocket. But anyway, he's going to come out on stage, and kids can take pictures with Blue, you know, and they kind of like that because he's real friendly and he's a lot of fun. So, you know.
Well, you are sneaky. You are sneaky, sneaky. This is a great way to get families to bring their kids along.
Well, we take this concert, we take to the schools. It's the one we do on the Wednesday. We take all our players take an afternoon off. And the next Sunday, we're taking it to Rockville, Indiana. The Park County Community Foundation's giving us a grant because they'd like to bring a symphony concert to Rockville. So
nice.
That's kind of funny. We're looking forward to that, too.
Nice. Yeah, good. Congratulations. Back to, I don't think that I would imagine live animals in the Brassy Chorus concert in March. Tell us about brass and adding brass.
It's basically a chorus concert, and we've got a brass group, and actually we had a schedule conflict, so we've had to change one or two of the players because of a schedule issue.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to do pieces for choir and some pieces for brass and some pieces that we can put the two of them together.
Some operatic choruses?
Actually, there are going to be some operatic choruses. Like, you know, I can't do a concert without some opera. I'm Italian, so what can I say?
It's in your blood, literally and figuratively.
And then after that, I've got two talent showcases, our first trumpet and our first flute are doing a talent showcase. And then we're doing the Pirates of Penzance, and we're putting together the cast for that now. It's a semi-staged performance.
Yeah, talk about that. What semi-staged means what?
Well, the orchestra's on stage, and you just kind of put holes in the orchestra, and you know, and people can come out and back and forward.
Okay.
We see a lot of this on PBS. You know,
constraints? What budget constraints?
Yeah, right. They call them concert performances but they're not really because they move around, and they walk around. You know, I wish I could have the gunfight with the pirates and the police. stage through the auditorium, but I don't think I'd get my chorus to do that right now. But, you know.
And for people who maybe have never seen or heard Pirates of Penzance, it's such a lark. It's so fun. It has a twisty plot. It's full of catchy tunes.
Well, and not only that, but I mean, because people don't realize Penzance even then was a seaside resort. It'd be like if we did it here, it would be Pirates of, I don't know, Indiana Beach or Geist Reservoir. I mean, it was the whole premise was silly, you know. Yeah. And of course, they're all forgiven because they're gentlemen at the end. But all Gilbert and Sullivan's end happily, which is a good thing.
Right. And it's typical Gilbert and Sullivan with those patter songs that have all the tongue twisters in them. And you have to listen really carefully to catch the lyrics.
Well, I find that in the Midwest, a lonely orphan boy... In often saying often boy, if they pronounce the R Midwestern style, people don't get the joke. Back in Boston, we say an often boy, and we often say an often boy, and this makes great sense. See?
Well, and especially since we're talking about a character who was born on Leap Day.
Right, that's true.
So
right.
He only has a birthday every 4 years.
Right, but we'll have to change the date at which he becomes 21.
A little bit,
yeah, yes. Because it's like 60-some 3 years or so down the road.
Maestro Benjamin Delvecchio is founder and music director of the Hendrix Symphony and Chorus. They perform in venues throughout Hendrix County and beyond. Learn about their performances and the wolf called Blue at hendrixsymphonic.org, and you can listen to music samples there, too. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, and I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, of course, they didn't know it was going to be World War I, so they called it the Great War, and we'll see it through Hoosier eyes. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger recently chatted with Brandywine Creek's Farm's Jonathan Lawler about his work to raise fresh produce for food banks and to eliminate food deserts. Tell me how the idea came about and what you're trying to do with the farms.
Well, it came about from my son telling me that there was a classmate of his that was taking home food from the food pantry at his school. My son goes to Eastern Hancock, which is...
So you're in a rural area?
Very rural. A lot of the trophies that you see displayed at Eastern Hancock, you know, have to do with agriculture.
FFA and things like that.
And they even have cattle there on campus, so...
So you're in the middle of a farming community.
Right. And I was just, you know, kind of taken aback. And I told him that he was probably mistaken. Mm-hmm. He was probably taking it home from the cafeteria for whatever reason. And he said, no, we have a food pantry. So I actually Googled it. Yeah. And they did. And then I talked to the principal. And, yeah, they have a full functioning food pantry that serves about 46 families. I wanted to. I started looking at a couple of farms. I actually watched a documentary called "A Place at the Table." It talked about food insecurity, and I remember there was a teacher that was working in a school that was passing out food, and she goes, "You know, I would love to be taking them fresh fruits and vegetables, but that's not what we get donated. We get donated boxes of processed food." So I talked to my wife, and you know, we talked about maybe planting an acre or two for that pantry. And I said, well, what if we turned all 36 acres at, you know, addressing the lack of produce? And she thought it was a great idea, and that's how we got started. We got with cleaners, we got with some other people and talked about it, and we decided let's address this for Central Indiana.
Now, you weren't aware that this was an issue until your son kind of brought it to your attention?
I had no idea that. I was so ignorant to hunger and what hunger looked like. And when I heard a doctor speak on it at a TED Talks, and he actually said in the United States, our poor, our food insecure, have a shorter lifespan than that of people that are food insecure in third world countries because they develop disease, heart disease, diabetes. I listened to a local doctor here talk about, she doesn't use the term adult onset diabetes anymore. She just calls it type 2 diabetes because it's affecting children. Yeah,
children and young people are affected by it.
Right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you have planned for this year. So last year was a successful year for Brandywine Creek Farms. Tell me what you have planned for 2017.
Are you planning right now? Are you figuring out what you're going to be planting this
season? Oh yeah. So we're working with Flanner House, which the community center, we're mm-hmm. helping them with their urban farm, Flanner Farms. And then besides that, we actually acquired 10 acres because I wanted to have the largest urban farm in the state of Indiana.
Okay.
We acquired 10 acres inside of the 465 loop. We're going to plant that as just a large urban farm. And then on top of that, we have acreage in Pendleton, and then we have our acreage in Greenfield.
And what's going to be growing?
So in the Pendleton, at the Pendleton property, which is right under 20 acres, we're growing nothing but sweet corn there. So, and then in Greenfield, off-site, away from actual Brandywine Creek Farm site, we'll be growing roughly 6 acres of green beans and probably 8 acres of sweet corn there. And then the Brandywine Creek Farm site, since we don't use synthetic chemicals, we'll be planting tomatoes, watermelons, peppers, and cucumbers and zucchini.
Now, you said you aren't using synthetic pesticides and that sort of thing. What type of farm is it? What kind of farming are you doing?
Well, we're not a certified organic farm, but we try to live by organic principles. So,
now, where will all this produce go?
A majority of it will be distributed through gleaners. You know, a small percentage of it goes to our own soup kitchens and food banks in Hancock County.
Well, that's what I wondered. Yeah. So you are still addressing that problem of food deserts right in your community?
Absolutely.
So how much do you intend to grow this year?
We're shooting for 1 million pounds.
1 million pounds of fresh produce?
Yeah, yeah. 750,000 of which will be donated. And the rest we are going to sell in a wholesale fashion to help cover our costs.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. The Circle City Industrial Complex is that big turquoise building on 10th Street just east of Mass Ave that's now home to a restaurant, a brewery, a meadery, and dozens of artist studios. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer discovered the newest artists making a home there.
They're called the Full Circle 9 Gallery, and they're located in the South Studio, Sharon. There have been artists in the North Studios for some time, but now the South Side is getting its fair shake. It's a collective of 9 artists. Many of them used to show their work at the Art Bank right down the street. So I sat down with artist Robin Toulouse to find out why they decided to make the move from Mass Ave to CCI.
Because Joy Hernandez, who is the president of the gallery, and Dan Haynes, who was the founder of Art Bank, started shopping around to find a place that we could go. We just decided that we wanted to be somewhere else. And they talked to Larry, the owner of Circle City Industrial Complex, and the deal was too hard to refuse. The rent is so reasonable, and it's so welcoming because there are so many other artists there and so many other galleries that everything about it just fell into place. It seemed like the right place.
And your space is really user-friendly. When you walk in, there's kind of a small little reception area, and then it opens up into bigger spaces. Why is it important to have a layout like that for artists?
Well, it's so nice because you have the central gathering area, as you mentioned. That's where on First Fridays food is, and people can mill around and eat there. And then they can come into the individual galleries, which are off of that central area. The Full Circle 9 Gallery is actually down a little hallway off of that area. And we're going to be the anchor of the South Studios when everything really gets up and running there. And we're pretty excited about it. Right now, we have a small lobby space and then one large gallery. But sometime later next year or this year, we hope to open a second space off of that second large room.
You guys are a cooperative as
yes.
well. Explain
yes.
that.
Well, all of us put everything into the gallery together. We all put money into it. We all put time into it. We all put sweat and blood into it. And literally a couple of, you know, little accidents have already happened there. So we've had our blood there already. And so we are all committed to it.
And it's a variety of different mediums of art, too.
That's
a little bit about that.
Right. That's exactly right. Yes, we have several painters. We have a photographer. And Dan Haynes, as I said, who founded the Art Bank, works in copper, and I'm an assemblage artist. Which means I create objects. I create pieces that are made up of photographs and objects that tell a story, and I assemble those in boxes.
And it's important to have a variety of different artists in a space like this.
It really is. We hope to be able to offer anybody who comes into the gallery something that will excite them.
And you guys are going to be open what hours?
Our hours are going to be 1 to 8 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, starting on first Friday, February 3rd.
And it's important to have those kind of longer hours on different days so people can come and visit.
That's right. And we're so close to downtown that somebody could pop in from on their way home from work late in the week. Or if they're visiting the other galleries on the north end of Circle City, they can sure drop in and see us as well. Or if you're on Mass Ave, we're just a little walk around the corner.
And you guys are looking for other artists to join your collective?
Yes, we are. We are. The original artists, I can tell you who we are. We have Joy Hernandez Butler, Dan Haynes, Andrew Kaling, Kim Ewing, Terrence Loftus, Rachel Illingworth, and me.
Robin Toulouse.
And Jean Dill, who was at the Art Bank as well, is also joining us. She'll be there for First Friday.
But if other artists are interested, they should get a hold of you guys?
Yes, they should get hold of us. And they can contact us via our website, which is fullcircle9, all spelled out, .com.
And if you want to learn more about their hours, because they are actually going to be open during the week, which is really nice because they're taking this seriously and they've got all this new space and they've got those 9 artists and then they're going to bring in some more artists at 2. So you go to their website. It's spelled out fullcircle9.com. And it's exciting to see all of that new space being used over there at Circle City Industrial Complex, Sharon.
It's a great time to be a visual artist in Indianapolis.
It really is. The pioneers have made it happen over there, and kudos to all of them.
Absolutely.
And a little sneak peek for people. The Yelp folks are going to do a little a tour of that building for their March Yelp event, too. So keep that on your mind for your upcoming calendar, too.
Hey, speaking of calendar, we have other things that you can do on that calendar that we call
What Will We Do?
Actually, I have a couple of completely different kinds of concerts at the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. The Milwaukee Symphony's music director, the Dutch conductor, Ado de Waard, who's been around for decades, has a great reputation. He's on the podium at Hilbert Circle Theater February 17th and 18th, next Friday and Saturday. Next Friday and Saturday, a little down the road. And the big piece on that program is Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, one of Beethoven's towering achievements. And a little behind-the-scenes look, you may know that it was named the Eroica because of Beethoven's admiration for Napoleon. But then Napoleon declared himself emperor of everything, and Beethoven got mad and scratched out the Eroica from the manuscript. And if you're like, oh, that's too serious for me, how about the Music of Queen on Saturday, February 25th at 8 o'clock? Music of Queen performed with a full rock band and vocals and showcasing Queen's distinct sound and lots of new musical colors as well. So something for everyone at the ISO.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I think that definitely shows that. So if you haven't been there yet, give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have been to the Walk the Talk series. This is this TED Talk-inspired spiritual talk series that Richard Brendan and a group of local people have been doing for the past year or so. Their next one is coming up on Wednesday, February the 15th at The Vogue. And the topic this time is miracles. And they have 6 speakers, and they're going to be talking about their personal stories, ranging from finding their true purpose in life to actually coming back to life after flatlining.
So, wow.
It's a very interesting evening, and tickets usually sell out pretty far in advance, so you might want to give the Vogue a call and make your reservation now. It's at 8 o'clock on Wednesday, February the 15th at thevogue.com to get your tickets for this event.
Hey, I wanted to call your attention to something happening right here on WFYI Public Radio. Monday nights this month, starting this coming Monday, February 6th at 9 o'clock, a series called Historically Black, gathering some fascinating voices and stories through history, from the Million Man March to the behind-the-scenes story of, if you've seen the film Hidden Figures, you'll know about the NASA human computers. And some of the people involved in making this radio show include Keegan-Michael Key and Roxane Gay, our own Indiana's Roxane Gay. Michelle Norris hosts this series, and again, you can hear it Monday nights this month at 9, right here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
At the IMA, it's time to eat orchids again. Sharon, you probably know this because you're a big gardener. It's their Toast to Tastings event. And this is another one that's very popular. Orchids are going to be on display through the month of February. What a wonderful thing to see in the coldest month of the year. And it's the Orchids Cultivating Beauty. You can sample wine and desserts that are all inspired and contain edible orchids. You need to go to the IMA website and get your ticket now.
And if you don't want to eat edible orchids at the IMA, you can also see them, and they're going to have the pop-up shop again, so you can take some home to brighten your house at this time of year. Speaking of things that brighten our lives, Theater on the Square is doing a series of readings of one of the best romantic two-actor plays ever. It's called Love Letters. It's by A.R. Gurney. And on a series of dates throughout the middle of this month, leading up to Valentine's Day, you can hear a series of local actors read love letters. Bill Simmons and Jolene Moffat, Scott Greenwell and Zach Neidich, Josh Ramsey and Carrie Schlatter, Claire Wilcher and Ben Asequi, just to name a few. You can find out more about that at tots.org.
Speaking of romance and actors, it's Dinner, a Romance in Four Courses. Once again, the No Exit Performance Company are doing this at Mesh Restaurant. It takes place on February the 26th. You get dinner and a play of sorts that kind of happens while you're dining. Another very popular event. So you want to go to the noexitperformance.org, to their website, and get your tickets now for the Dinner, a Romance in Four Courses on February 26th at Mesh on Mass.
And if we haven't given you enough ideas, don't forget you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or tune back in next week for our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. The Indiana Historical Society has a new exhibit honoring the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I. It's called The Great War Through Hoosier Eyes, and the cabaret's Shannon Forsell talked with Emily Engel of IHS Exhibitions and Suzanne Hahn, Vice President of Archives and Library, about the exhibit.
Emily, you really did a lot of work to put this exhibit together. So tell us about it and tell us what people are going to experience when they come and see this exhibit.
So we began this exhibit wanting to look specifically at what the Indiana Historical Society had to offer in terms of studying World War I. So I began in the collections and started seeing what we really had, and realized we had some fabulous collections of letters, diaries, postcards, and oral histories. So we looked at the exhibit through that lens and kind of designed everything around that. So visitors will be able to experience the war through individual, ordinary men and women from Indiana's past who lived through it and documented that history just through writing letters home, through writing in their diaries, through saving postcards when they were in France or Germany. And then also we have some neat technology that we've been able to use to display some oral histories that were done of World War I veterans in the 1980s. It's a very neat exhibit because we look at both the broad story of the war through the postcards we've attached. We featured some stories, some famous stories from the war so that viewers can get some of that content, but also at the exact same time that we're looking at this broad general story, we've been able to focus in on individual Hoosiers and get a really personal side.
That's fantastic. So I imagine there's some really poignant and moving elements to this. And with you putting it together, is there something that really sticks out for you as a really moving story that really struck you emotionally?
Yes, there's a very sad story. As I was going through some of the letters, there was an individual, I believe he was about 18 or 19 years old, from Indiana, who went overseas to France to serve in the war. And he wrote a letter home in October of 1918 to his parents and just saying, everything's great, don't worry about me, things are fine. Within a few weeks of writing that letter, he actually contracted Spanish influenza and died. Mm. But because it takes several weeks for these letters to go back and forth between France and the United States, there are letters that we have in the collection from his father over 3 weeks after his death, writing to him saying, why haven't you written to us? Like, please let us know you're okay. So it was very, very moving and very emotional and sad to read this letter and just imagine, like, you have the actual paper and the ink here of this father who's writing to his son who he hasn't heard from, not knowing that he's actually been dead over 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And so we have both of those letters and then some letters from family members afterwards, after the family found out, of offering their condolences. It's a sad story, but I thought it was very interesting that we had the full story. So you have letters not only from the son, but from the parent and then family members. So you're able to get a full picture just through the letters themselves.
So this is an amazing thing to me that we, you know, that we have access to all of these, you know, how do we get these letters? How do they come about? How is there enough for an entire collection? Suzanne, can you tell me kind of how archives fits into that and how these materials were collected? How long did it take? And how that kind of all fits in with all of this?
Sure, sure. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to tell and preserve stories like Emily was describing. We've been collecting for years and years and years all sorts of stories on documenting Indiana's history. We get them through donations from family members. We get them through organizations. And we really try to tell everyone's story. You know, in this case with World War I, there's so many amazing letters and diaries and photographs and posters, oral histories, that help tell that story, that help describe what Hoosiers were facing both overseas, but also here on the home front. And so when we get a chance to work with exhibits and help highlight those stories, we welcome it. It's a great way to share the stories, highlight the items from the collection. But I also want to stress that the collection's for everyone to use. They can certainly come and enjoy the exhibits, but they can certainly also come to our library and research them yourself. If you had a family member or an ancestor or someone you knew, or you just want to learn more about World War I, you can come and use our library anytime. It's free and open to the public. And you can actually handle these letters. You can actually see these photographs firsthand and learn more about the experiences.
That's amazing. So if you think you had a family member, you can come in and look that person up and possibly find more details about them.
Sure. You might find that we have a collection of their letters, or you might find that we have letters from someone who was serving with them, so you have a broader understanding of what their experiences were like. Or even if you didn't have a family member who was serving, you could get a better understanding of what family members who were here at that time period, here on the home front, what they were doing to help with the war effort as well.
The Cabaret's Shannon Forsell talked with Indiana Historical Society staffers Suzanne Hahn and Emily Engel. The Great War Through Hoosier Eyes is on view at the Indiana History Center through July 8th. In honor of Black History Month, you can view the unique works of 25 locally prominent African-American artists during the 29th annual Meet the Artists exhibit through March 26th throughout Central Library. I invited curator Tony Radford, poet and singer Victoria Hawes, and photographer Lenny White in for a preview. So, Tony, we're going to bring you back in a minute, but I'd like to start with Victoria. How did you know about Meet the Artists before you were recruited to participate this year?
Absolutely. Meet the Artists has been almost like a pinnacle of reaching a certain status as a performance artist in Indianapolis since I've been performing. So actually a few of the other like heavy hitters in the poetry mm-hmm. scene and the spoken word scene that I know of have done Meet the Artist. So it was just kind of an honor once it was brought to me to come and participate that someone of that caliber saw me and referenced me mentally with those other heavy hitters. So absolutely, it's been well known and an honor to be a part of.
What a great compliment. Are you creating new work for Meet the Artists, or are you culling from some of your favorite recent work?
There is a piece that I have now, it's called Black Magic, that I try to end all of my sets with. It's more of a self-affirming, positive image, uplifting piece about women, mm-hmm. In particular women of color. And then I am also going to come up with a new piece relative to kind of what's going on in the city of Indianapolis specifically, also in reference to our children and kind of where that is with a lot of them coming out of school and all of these new things that are going on in the city. I will have something that relates specifically to that for this show.
I have a process question. Mm-hmm. Do you have a muse? Does a muse just visit you unanticipatedly, or is it more intentional? Do you say, this is something that's been occupying my mind, I'm mm-hmm. going to write about it, I'm going to sit down at this time and place and write? How does that work for you?
It just kind of depends on the situation. If I'm asked to do something specifically for like a wedding or mm-hmm. a graduation or something like that, then I'll try to come up with a piece that's relative to what's going on. So it's not necessarily just this muse visits me and I just get this inspiration and I'm just on the page writing or singing because I'm also a vocalist. Mm-hmm. But for events like this where there's not really a guide for content,
right.
Then it's like, okay, there was a reason why I was invited to come and perform here. Let me search my spirit, my mind, whatever's going on within me. What is telling me needs to be said at this particular time? And then that's the situation where I guess you would kind of say it's almost like a out-of-body experience, and then you get the inspiration and put it on the page.
Leonard, do you have a muse? Lenny, I'm sorry. I'm not going to call you by your formal name. You'll feel like you're in trouble.
Right.
Do you have a process? Is there a little muse that comes and sits on your shoulder and directs your camera?
Well, actually, I'm an event photographer,
mm-hmm.
and I'm new to the art world.
This is something okay.
This is something I just started. This will be my second showing.
Wow.
But I've been involved with Meet the Artists for maybe the last 6 or 7 years as a photographer covering the whole event.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy shooting the fashion show segment of it. That's one of my favorite areas. But as an artist, this is new territory for me.
Good. We're going to have to get you back after the show and see what the story arc, what path you took between now and then. So what pushed you over the edge into taking photographs for a price, for events, and obviously helping people celebrate important things in their lives? But what pushed you over into now I want to do even more and I want to explore art?
Well, I was involved in a collaboration photo shoot called Decolonized Minds, and it gave me an opportunity to put on film some of my political views,
mm-hmm.
and so it sort of grew out of that.
Cool. Tony, as you have become curator extraordinaire through the years, and you didn't really, I don't think you intended to come all the way down this path, but you have this amazing opportunity to gather this new collective of artists every year. What does that do for your own art?
Well, been around different artists, different styles of art. It helps me. If I listen to a poet, if it hits me, I can go do a piece, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It inspires me. Being around other artists just inspires, you know, no matter whether it's visual artists, performing artists, dance, you know, I get motivated and creative and I've, you know, want to mix people, you know, back in the 90s, we used to do a visual artists and poets, and the poet would have to look at my piece or other artist's piece and write something, and we'd have to listen to their works and create something. And it's just inspiring for me. And like you said, it just fell in my lap. And I took that opportunity and ran with it, man. You know, we had lack of venues to show our creative talent, so I wanted this to be the spot for African-American artists to create their talents during Black History Month. So, and it's just grown phenomenally, man. I mean, I never in my wildest dreams would think that I'd be doing something for 30 years this big. And I mean, from the beginnings to now, what it takes to put it together, other people, other departments are involved. So, you know, I want to thank my employers, the library, who have gotten behind this, especially Central Library. For 29 years, you know, I've been able to do what I want to do, bring different artists, different unique types of artists. And when I'm out and about, like I said, when I met Victoria, she woke me up.
So literally and figuratively.
Right.
Yeah.
So I had to go over and talk, you know, and I'm usually out and about in the art scene, you know, so I'm always looking for whatever hits me, you know, whatever makes me feel good or whatever I think's going to make the audience feel good. And so far, you know, it's been great. We've had our biggest audience at our 20th anniversary was 2,889 people, a door count. So
you're going to beat that this year.
Hopefully. Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
We heard from curator Tony Radford, poet and singer Victoria Hawes, and photographer Lenny White. They're just three of the more than 25 African-American artists whose work will be featured throughout Central Library at the 29th annual Meet the Artists event. There's a free gala opening reception on Saturday, February 11th from 5 to 10 p.m. with food and drink, art demonstrations, music, and lots of activities for kids. Again, that opening gala is next Saturday, February 11th, and you can get the details at indiepl.org. It's time for a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long to talk five songs.
Smile and say hello. Smile and say hello. Smile and say hello.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Daniel Parquette, better known to parents out there listening and kids as Mr. Daniel, a very prolific children's music performer here in Indianapolis. Daniel, you have five songs to share with us today. And if I understand this correct, these are the five most listened to songs on your Spotify account for 2016.
That's right. The top five songs that Mr. Daniel listened to last year and hence influenced your little kids.
Great. What is your first, your most listened to song of 2016?
It's the song The Wild Flowers by an Irish songwriter named John Spillane. If only one song is played at my funeral that isn't my one of my songs, this is the song I want played. And I've told my wife that she has specific instructions to play this song at my funeral if she's around. So it's an amazing song. I don't know what else to say. You'd have to listen to it. I could recite all the lyrics.
Well, let's listen to it. Yeah.
"'Twas the wild flowers I preferred, who owed nothing to nobody, who blossomed in the ditches and made their own way."
And number two.
This is a song by an artist that is very unknown. It's a song called Phantom, by an artist named Joanna Coonan, and she now goes by the name Bright Archer, but she's from Seattle or Portland, and I got her CD, and this song Phantom is something that I listen to all the time. It reminds me of my grandmother.
I am a wanderer.
Banger, The Mother We Share by Churches. I don't know why, but I have to listen to that song a lot. I really like it.
Never teach
never close your name. I keep my lips shut tight until you go. Oh, oh, oh.
Number four.
A song by one of my favorite artists of all time, Leonard Cohen, the song Suzanne. The first song off of his first album.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy. But that's why you wanna be there. And she.
We're here with Mr. Daniel. He's sharing his top five most listened to songs in 2016 off his Spotify account. And Daniel, what's your fifth and final song for us?
Oh yeah, this one's super special. It's Jacking the Ball by the Sea and Cake. I love that song. I was lucky enough to actually teach Sam Prekop's children at the preschool I taught at in Chicago back in 2010, 2011. And I was able to meet Sam and become friendly with him and share my love of this song with him in person. And that meant a lot to me. And this song is just the jam. I don't know if you agree with me, if you like this song, but it's the bomb.
Sacrination bows to the young. Nothing's wicked, everything's fun. You got some money, do it right. We are jacking the ball. One tear, amazingly.
And Daniel, you have a new album out, Mr. Daniel Feels the Love, right? Tell folks where they can get this album.
You can go to my website at smileandsaygoodmorning.com. You can also purchase it from local record stores, Indie CD and Vinyl, and Luna Music.
All right, thank you, Daniel, for sharing this music with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown, Shannon Frisell, and Jill Dittmeyer. You can hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll learn about a carnival that benefits education in Kenya and meet man's best friend at a new exhibit at the Idlejorg. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.